Coming up on today's program.
I was evacuated 3 times in LA from the fires, and we had earthquakes that were really bad, and then we had riots. And I can tell you that when any of those things happen, you will see people flying out to help people they have never met before.
Big cities, small towns, and helping neighbors. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. That clip you heard at the top of the program from One Small Step, one of WISO's latest series. Up first, we're going to start off with this new series. During this Black History Month, we're sharing stories about community, memory, and why radio preservation matters. It's Legacy Listening, HBCU Radio Memories, our series featuring excerpts from oral histories collected by the HBCU Radio Preservation Project. Here's Charles Fox, general manager of Jazzy 88.9 WCSU at Central State University in Wilberforce, Ohio.
There was always storytelling going on in the family. For example, my name, my great-grandfather, John Fox, after he was freed during the emancipation, he learned that there had been arguments between George Washington and his younger brother, Charles, over the morality of owning slaves, that the younger brother, Charles, always challenged his older brother. George insulted that his younger brother was challenging his authority and his opinions, said, "I will make sure that your name is never remembered in history." And so my great-grandfather said, "I'll make sure his name is remembered in history." And he named his first son Charles Washington Fox. So he's the senior and my father's junior. So I'm the third child, third generation, born free. My full name is Charles Washington Fox III. I am general manager at WCSU Radio, Central State University. This is the first place I've been in a long time where people have been in one place almost all their lives, or people have come here to go to school and are still here 20 years later. I've realized the value and to appreciate what Central State University means to people in the community who have been here all their lives. It is the first federally licensed HBCU radio station in the nation. I started in 2020. The first thing was that we were almost ready to lose our license, so I had to scramble, pull that together. And then the other issue is there are jazz listeners around the world, but how do I maintain that brand in this environment? This was a Black community initially, and it's changing because the younger generations of the families that were here historically have been moving on to better opportunities. So there's a gentrification that's taken place. And the answer came, it's a fight for democracy. The jazz ambassadors, when Adam Clayton Powell realized that whites were coming into clubs in Harlem to hear jazz, he saw the cross-cultural relevance of it. And he pitched an idea to President Eisenhower and the State Department that jazz could be a way of promoting democracy. So Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, Dave Brubeck were sent around the world. And so I started in this current climate. I saw that jazz is a symbol of democracy. And so that's what we should remember and hold on to. I can't imagine the joy that people must have felt hearing intellectual thought and sounds of entertainment that reflected their experience. That's one thing that's important, is to have your own cultural reflection. The other thing is, I got a message from a woman. She says, "Hi, I'm just a 60-year-old white woman out here living on a farm, but I just want to tell you I love your music." And we got a postcard from a woman from Yellow Springs saying, "Thank you for saving my sanity during COVID." Got a call from people in Colorado. "Hey, what happened? You guys went off the air for a minute. What was it? We're missing you. We love your show." Somebody in Colorado? It's saying that we're doing something right, and they are connected to it. It is not a nice thing to do what the HBCU preservation. It's not a nice thing. It's a critical. It's a necessary thing. It's an act of resistance and an act of resilience.
That was Charles Fox, General Manager of WCSU at Central State University in Wilberforce. Legacy Listening, HBCU Radio Memories, is produced by the HBCU Radio Preservation Project at the Center for Radio Preservation and Archives at WYSO. To learn more about radio preservation, you can visit WYSO.org. Up next on WYSO Weekend, together with StoryCorps, WYSO invited the community to participate in one small step and connect with someone in the region they had never met before to compare experiences. Here's Jennifer Davis of Cincinnati and Beth Taylor of Troy, who share their takes on the differences between small towns and big cities.
So you're from Cincinnati?
Born and raised in Cincinnati.
Lot of my kin. Yeah. Folk are from
Cincinnati.
It
now, too. I didn't even know if I would like it, but I really like it.
Oh, really? Yeah. So, but you, what took you to everywhere?
The first place I left when I was 24, I think it was I was engaged, and we moved to L.A., but I did break up with him in St. Louis on the way out. So that was a little weird.
Did you really?
But I stayed in L.A. We went all the way out. I stayed in L.A.
And then, car ride.
And then I lived and worked there, you know, for 30 years, I guess. But I have traveled a lot because I love different cultures, different people. So I have been all over.
I mean, I've vacationed in New York and Los Angeles, but I've always lived in Ohio. I live in Troy, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
So I've always lived there.
Right. Yeah. And
so that's really cool.
And that's kind of nice. I mean, so I wanted to ask you about this, where you said you feel like smaller towns they feel like they help people more, tell me about that.
I do. I feel like that. I went away for a couple of years and lived in the big city of Columbus, but I feel like this is just me. I'm not speaking for everyone in Troy, right? But I'm sure that this happens in every town, but you know, if your neighbor's their car broke down, like, you would help them get to work. Or if Jan, two doors down, needed help babysitting, well, my mom's going to say, hey, Beth can babysit your kids so you can go out. Like,
I'm moving to Troy.
Hey, I can get you to work. My neighborhood, like, all the moms know each other and all the dads play poker on Friday nights. Like, I just didn't feel like a big city had that.
And I think you're right. But in terms of helping other people, I do believe people inherently want to help. And I can talk about disasters. I was evacuated 3 times in L.A. from the fires. And we had earthquakes that were really bad. And then we had riots. And I can tell you that when any of those things happen, you will see people flying out to help people they have never met before. And
really?
They have never met you before, and they're helping you, right? So, yeah, like when the riots happened, the Rodney King riots, my car broke down. And I was stuck in the middle of L.A., and I could see smoke around me. You know, I had to keep walking. And I can't tell you how many people stopped to say, can I take you somewhere? So it happens.
That's good to hear.
It's just different, right? But I think it's there. You know, I think it's there.
I hear what you're saying, but I feel like in general, we help each other out. Why do I need these government programs telling me I need to help somebody out? Because we're doing that on our own. So it's just shaped the way.
You know, for me, like, I can put it in terms of being a female and trying to go up the ladder.
I hear you about that too.
You know, I'm old enough to remember when, oh God, the most horrible kinds of interviews, the most sexist, misogynistic kind of interviews. And I don't have to do that anymore. Because we as a community, as a society, said, that's not right. We're going to change it. And who changes things? Who does everybody look for to change things? The government. The government actually says, no, here's the right thing to do. That's what changes things for the better. That's my...
Yeah. I mean, it's something to think. It's just a different way to think.
Yeah.
Which is why we're here.
Yes, exactly.
That was Beth Taylor and Jennifer Davis. One Small Step with WISO is produced by the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WISO. This series is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and presented by the Charles F. Kettering Foundation. Up next on our program, on Monday evening last, a federal judge ruled that termination of temporary protected status for 330,000 Haitians in the U.S. would be paused while a lawsuit continues. But the threat to their legal status isn't over. WISO's Adriana Martinez-Smiley spoke with Dayton immigration lawyer Karen Bradley. Here's more on what the ruling means and what legal options exist for Haitians.
Haitians are eligible to retain their employment authorization and their temporary protected status in the United States until there is a further decision that may extend it further or have it redesignated for an additional 18-month extension.
Does this change the likelihood at all of ICE deployment in Springfield?
I don't know if it will change the likelihood of them coming to Springfield. I don't know why they would. I mean, considering that the majority of these folks would be under the protection of having this status.
Is it something that lawyers are still trying to understand what exactly are the implications from this recent ruling?
Right now, we're all sort of, I feel like we're in limbo. Because yes, the ruling says, yeah, the early termination was unlawful, but then what? Are they going to extend TPS? We haven't seen that. All we know now, based on that ruling, it is not terminated.
So we've heard officials like Senator Bernie Moreno or DHS Secretary Kristi Noem say that there's the option of self-deportation. What are the practical and legal challenges that come with self-deportation for Haitians specifically?
None of these nationals want to return to a country that is completely destroyed by gang violence and just a broken down economy and infrastructure. Self-deportation, yeah, we've seen it. We've had clients that have made the decision that they want to do it. I don't know the exact process of going about doing that because that's not something I have encouraged my clients to do, especially those clients who have been here for more than 2 or 3 or 4 years. So I would not encourage it.
While this case is pending, is there anything that TPS recipients can do to reinforce their ability to stay in the U.S.?
If any TPS holder has a reasonable fear or a credible fear of persecution for returning to Haiti, they should file an asylum application to get the additional protection of remaining in the United States. Anyone who has a credible fear of persecution on the basis of their race, their religion, nationality, political opinion, membership in a particular social group, they should do that. What everybody from Haiti wants to ensure that you have in place is something that provides you an opportunity to remain in this country lawfully. You know, any kind of family-based immigration benefits can also be applied for. And there are some employment-based options that may be available. Other relief such as VAWA or U visas or SIJS, those are other options that may also be available in the event the information is there. And my last part of this, I would say if DHS, you know, if the Department of Homeland Security succeeds in lawfully terminating Haiti's TPS, you know, after appeals or a new proper decision, TPS holders will then face options very similar to what has happened to South Sudan and other Venezuelan TPS holders. They would either have to depart to their country or a third country, stay in the U.S. and risk everything, detention, deportation, or seek any other immigration benefit that's available.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, you're welcome.
Dayton immigration lawyer Karen Bradley speaking with WISO's Adriana Martinez-Smiley. The Trump administration has signaled it will appeal the Monday ruling. NPR reports that DHS spokesperson Tricia McLaughlin referred to the decision as, quote, lawless activism, unquote. Well, this winter is bringing some extreme cold, record-breaking snow, and now breaking water mains. That includes a couple last week, Burkhardt Avenue and Weiss Roads in Dayton. These ruptures can cause holes in the street and loss of water pressure for those nearby. We asked Ben Bennett, operations manager for field services at Montgomery County Environmental Services, about what causes the ruptures and how they're fixed.
With the change in weather and the cold, the ground shifts, and it creates havoc on our water mains in the ground. So the ground, it freezes and falls, and just moves a lot underground. People don't realize that. And sometimes they'll even hear the ground cracking at night, and that's the ground moving. And our water mains are usually buried about 4 to 5 feet in the ground, which is normally below the freeze line. But when you get these extreme cold temperatures, you'll get movement even down there, and it causes the mains to break.
And what are those mains made of, those pipes?
Most of our system is cast iron, but the new stuff going into the ground is ductile iron, and the cast isn't as strong as the new ductile iron, but we have miles and miles and miles of the old cast still in our system.
Now, cast iron doesn't sound like it flexes as much, so when the ground around it shifts and it just breaks?
Yes, sir. It's kind of like thinking like a pretzel rod, I guess. If you grab a hold of a pretzel rod and you put pressure in the middle of it, because the ground around it's moving, it would just kind of snap in half.
And you have crews, I assume, on call 24/7, so whenever a break happens and whatever the temperature is, they have to go out there and take care of it?
We do.
So when a break actually happens, your crews come out there, what exactly do they do?
So first they assess what kind of damage is happening with the road and where the water is going. And then first thing they start to do is to look for a way to isolate the break. So we have valves that are out in the street most of the time, but some of them are off in the grassy areas, or some of our mains even run behind homes and what we consider an easement. But they will start to look for the valves to try and isolate it, to throttle what we call throttling the main down, which is reducing the amount of water going through the pipe so that we don't lose as much water and it doesn't cause as much damage. And it also makes it much easier for us to make the repairs.
If people live nearby a water main break, should they expect discolored water or lower water pressure, or does it depend on the severity of the break?
It depends on the severity of the break. We try to keep people in full pressure as long as we can, because sometimes, I mean, we have some that just aren't as severe as others. And times like this, we're trying to take care of the more severe and busier roads. And then they can still have discolored water. It's usually really brief. If they do have that, we usually tell people to run the cold water in their tubs. And it'll usually clear up within 5 or 10 minutes.
Is it dangerous to drink in terms of bacteria, or is it just sediment?
It's not dangerous to drink. It's just sediments.
I don't suppose there's anything that anybody can do to make your lives easier.
Patience. Patience is huge for us. If you see the crews out working, they will close the roads. We ask people to give them room. There's a lot of dangerous things that the guys are doing, and they don't want to have to worry about looking over their shoulder for traffic coming through our road closures.
Ben Bennett with Montgomery County Environmental Services speaking with WISO's Mike Frazier. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend. Nashville artist Koshona is returning to Southwest Ohio next week for a performance at Clark State Performing Arts Center on February 13th. She's previously performed at Levitt Pavilion Dayton as part of their summer concert series. WISO Music Director Juliet Frumholt spoke to Koshona about her upcoming performance and how she combines music with healing practices.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the start of your career. I know you started as a music therapist and then decided that you were going to, you know, pursue your own career alongside, you know, the advocacy work that you continue to do. Was there a particular moment where you said, okay, I've been using music as this tool to help others, and now I'm feeling like called to do it myself? What was that decision like for you?
I mean, honestly, what led to that shift was burnout. You know, I was burned out working in mental health in Atlanta. I was working in mental health hospitals and working with youth, working with people that were incarcerated. And back then, we weren't talking about self-care. Nobody was talking about taking breaks. Meditation wasn't something people were using frequently in our language. So I hit a breaking point. It was like, I'm not okay. My last job was working with teens in Athens, Georgia. And I was using the summertime when I wasn't in the schools to go and just be on the road, tour, explore. And I used that as a way to meet my friends, but or like to hang out with friends that I hadn't seen in forever. But you know, and sometimes you know, like, this season is ending and I don't know what's next, but I'm getting satisfaction out of touring the country and sharing. Like, I started writing songs as a way to, like, shake off the things that I was taking in as a full-time therapist. And so when I would go perform those songs in front of audiences, I noticed people would come up to me and say, me too, I've had this experience. And so I figured I'll give myself a year of touring the country, sharing these songs about the experiences I've seen, the stories I've heard. And then I found that this work as a touring artist was still doing therapy work, but just with people who had a net to catch them, people who were just like a hair's breadth away from being institutionalized themselves. And I mean, it was something I thought would be a year, but now it's been like 17 years, I think, now that I've been touring full time as an artist, and I've incorporated music therapy back into my work now.
And you have an organization called Your Song. And I know when you performed at Levitt Pavilion Dayton, you worked with some of our local folks at YWCA Dayton.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how you are balancing the work of an artist and mm-hmm. the work of a healer, even though they are intertwined. Those are, you know, those are two very big things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it was in 2020 when we were all pulled, when artists were pulled from the road, and I was feeling disconnected from audiences. And I knew that the stories I was telling, the songs I was sharing, people were telling me they were healing. So I just figured, like, what's the way I can connect? I can help other people tell their stories. I can't write songs right now in 2020 because I'm stressed, but maybe I can help you write yours. And the amount of my fans that reached out and said, like, I would love this right now, I have time to contemplate and work through things, that led to this therapeutic songwriting company that I have now, where it's basically I'm helping people through the journaling process, where they learn basically how to express themselves freely. And then we're taking their actual words and putting those into song. And now what I'm able to do is when I'm touring it through a town or through a county, we reach out to either the Levitt Pavilions or we'll reach out to the performing arts centers and say, hey, is there an organization you feel like would really benefit from some deep therapeutic work through songwriting? And can we write them an anthem? And it's really beautiful to see the performing arts centers look around their communities, you know, and say, like, actually, yes, can we go visit this program that is for people in recovery? And I'll go in hopefully like a week or a day ahead, you know, we'll write the song. And my mission is to bring those people to the stage, because something I've learned as a Black woman on the microphone is that Kashana, when she is on the mic, she has the power at that moment. She has everyone's attention. And that's not something a lot of people get. And so to be able to give people in the community the microphone to tell their story, that's a connection with the audience that can continue on long after I'm gone. And it's all through song. And it's amazing what music can do as far as opening ears of an audience to where they are captivated and you can't leave. You bought a ticket, you know? So listen to the stories of your community members. And I love that I've been able to plant little song seeds around the country in communities, and hopefully showing the community that these performing arts centers are there. Because a lot of the audiences that performing arts centers are older people who can't afford this ticket, right? And it's just a way of reconnecting people with the arts to let them know this is your community too. And I think when I'm with that in mind, it has shifted how I write. I'm thinking more globally. About what is the bigger issue here that we are struggling with as a country and as a people, as humanity.
You
Music from Koshona, speaking with WYSO's music director, Juliet Fromholtz. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend.
This is Bird Note. You've probably heard the old saying, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Well, it's a very old saying, and it's gone through some changes over the years. The phrase first pops up in a 7th century Aramaic proverb. Better is a sparrow held tight in the hand than 1,000 birds flying about in the air. An English book from the 15th century had this version. It is more certain a bird in your fist than to have 3 in the sky above. 100 years later, there was another old English saying. Better one bird in hand than 10 in the wood. In each era, the pragmatic wisdom is clear. Hold on to the sure thing rather than taking a gamble on something better. The old saying eventually made it to Pennsylvania, where there's a town named Bird in Hand. Legend has it that when two road surveyors in the early 1700s were trying to decide whether to stay the night where they were working or head back to Lancaster, one cited the Bird in Hand proverb. They decided to stay, and the place was named Bird in Hand. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support wild bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients in every blend. Available at Chewy.com.
And that's a wrap on this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks so much for sharing your weekends with WYSO. Just a reminder, this program is a podcast, and you can download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Our theme music was provided by Magnolia Bolthead. The tune is called Another Beautiful Day in Paradise. We hope there are many of those ahead for you. We've got more highlights and conversations for you next weekend. Please join us then.